The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. I'll run through the announcements real quickly. I want to spend as much time as possible talking with our guest today. For those of you who would like to call us and talk with our guest, Laura Montgomery, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. If you happen to be outside the United States and you're listening and you want to call us, because this may have some implications for you in another country as well. So our toll-free number is an MCI number. And if your country allows toll-free calling back to the United States, then what you want to do is call and ask for your local MCI operator. And then tell your MCI operator you want to connect to 866-687-7223 in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they should connect you. And if they don't offer toll-free, I believe you can just direct dial our toll-free number here in the United States. But that may not be toll-free for you. I'm not sure how that would work at your end. And if that doesn't work, you can email me, and I'll send you the actual phone number, which you can direct dial. And so email for us is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a comment or a question for our guest on our blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right, upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. Click on that. That is our archive page for this show. And then comments and questions are all the way down at the bottom. You do not have to be logged in to discuss. That's our program for comments. To do this, but just click on it, and I'll get your comment, and I can integrate it into the program at the first opportunity. But again, the preferred way of communicating with us is always our telephone, 1-866-687-7223. We actually want to hear from you, not receive an email, if possible. So again, our Space Show website is thespaceshow.com. Our detailed weekly newsletter will be uploaded to the Space Show site later today, after today's program ends. It will have all of the details for the coming week's programming, and it will have a considerably updated list of programs going through early October. Everything we do is archived, and you can easily download our programs or listen right off of our website. In the upper left menu, there is a store under support if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. There is also a button called Listen Live, and this tells you how to listen to a live or an archived Space Show program. Feel free to share that information. And then there's also a support area, and if you go over to the center right, you'll see our support for both Amazon. Amazon has some great programs for supporting nonprofits. If you click on our big Amazon link, you will be directed to those programs and how to access them for the Space Show accounts. And in addition, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And you can click on our PayPal link. We are able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially support us with your contributions. Remember, as a tax-free organization, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. We're a California Public Benefit Corporation, so for California, you also get a tax deduction if you pay California taxes. Check us out at giantleapfoundation.org or email me for details at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do also have corporate sponsors, and you'll see their banner ads going across the website. Do click on them from time to time. The sponsors do change their message, and so it's not always the same once you click on it. And we wouldn't be here without the corporate sponsors either. So please check them out and see what they have to say. And then remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have all of our permission to download our shows and to share them and pass them around. But please don't do anything commercial with them. Don't edit, cut, copy, take clips and put them up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. And our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our Space Show website pages, as well as those for OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. If you have any special needs for a Space Show program or any special requests, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do have a couple of sponsors that I'm going to read the messages for both the first segment of today's show and the second segment. So, again, for the first segment, we do have the Integrated Space Plan. This is the detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space. It includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. Their website, where all of this is available, is thespaceplan.com. If you look at it online, it's interactive, so if you click on the more than 500 elements, they all expand into more information. They have a new revised plan that was announced at ISDC at the end of June, and they also have a kids' space plan now. So you can get all that information at their website, and you can also buy a full-size color poster of the space plan to hang on your wall or your living room or wherever you want to put it. It's pretty cool, and I suggest you do so. Again, thespaceplan.com is their website. And then the Space Foundation sponsors us, and they're already working on their 34th symposium, which will be April 16th through the 19th in 2018. Again, it'll be in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel, which is incredible. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. If you've never been to the Broadmoor, it really is exceptional. And networking is amazing. Different people than attending a Space Advocate conference. You'll make all sorts of new and different contacts and hear lots of really cool topics discussed. So check it out, spacesymposium.org. And I'm happy to bring back to the Space Show, this is her third visit, if we count Hotel Mars, space attorney Laura Montgomery. Laura specializes in regulatory space law with an emphasis on commercial space transportation and the outer space treaties. She provides expert opinion on Commercial Space Launch Act, its implementing regulations governing the launch of launch vehicles, the reentry of reentry vehicles, the operation of launch and reentry sites, and financial responsibility and liability requirements of those regulations. She has testified in March of this year at the Space Subcommittee and the House Committee on Science and Space and Technology, and more recently at the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation's Space Committee on Space Science and Competitive on Matters of Regulation in International Obligation. She spent over two decades with the FAA. She served as the manager of Space Law Branch in the FAA's Office of the Chief Counsel, and before that she was the FAA Senior Attorney for Commercial Space Transportation as the FAA's Space Lawyer. And she supported the Office of Commercial Space Transportation. You can read all about her and her background on our website. Her full bio is there and posted along with her photo. Time to talk with Laura rather than for me to read about her. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Oh, very good, David. Thank you. And thank you for having me back. I enjoyed talking with you last time.
Always a pleasure. And when you were on last time, not the Hotel Mars segment, but the regular space show, as we were ending, you put out this teaser. We should talk sometime about Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty, because you might be shocked to know that it's I think you said it's not applicable or not valid or something. And, you know, that prompted me to ask you a couple more questions. But, of course, the show was over. So we've been doing shows with Planetary Protection Office for years with Cassie and John and other people and other attorneys. And everybody just assumes planetary protection is a U.S. law and a United Nations law. So what's the story here?
Well, I have a very narrow legal point to make about Article 9's harmful contamination provisions. And the bottom line is that it does not apply to commercial U.S. actors. Clearly, you know, the government view is that it applies to government activities such as NASA's or DOD's activities. So I'm definitely not addressing that, and I would not take issue with NASA on their own interpretation of the harmful contamination provision. So I guess I should sort of give a little background first. Would that be helpful, David?
Yes, sure.
Why I say these outlandish things?
Yes.
So, you know, if you read the if you read Article 9, it says that states parties to the treaty shall pursue studies of outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, and conduct exploration of them so as to avoid their harmful contamination and also adverse changes in the environment of the Earth resulting from the introduction of extraterrestrial matter, and, where necessary, shall adopt appropriate measures for this purpose. So this is all very good stuff, and I do want to say at the outset that I am not in favor of the Andromeda strain reaching my home planet and killing us all. And I don't think, you know, we should, you know, paint the moon orange or anything like that. But what I do want to talk about is what Article 9 says as a legal matter. In other words, does it really say anything about commercial actors? And I think that it doesn't. So there's two things to consider. One, you know, the U.S. Constitution says that treaties are the law of the land. So what am I talking about if treaties are the law of the land and here we have this provision? Well, one of the things that lawyers do when they're reading the law is they read all of the words, and all of the words mean what you usually think they mean. They don't mean other things. They mean what they say. And so when you read Article 9 on harmful contamination, it says states parties to the treaty shall pursue studies, et cetera, and avoid harmful contamination. So because it says the states parties, it's talking about the governments, the nations. It is not talking about commercial actors. And we know that they mean the states as opposed to the commercial actors, because later on in Article 9, there's a provision about interfering with, you know, like your people will interfere with other foreign people. So they call them out there, and they make it clear that they, when they want to talk about non-governmental entities, they can do so. So what we have, it's, you know, laws are called codes, going back to the Code of Hammurabi, and I know a lot of your listeners are familiar with coding and computer science. You have to be really specific and precise. And so they said states parties, they meant states parties. So while Article 9 harmful contamination may apply to NASA because it's part of the government, it does not apply to commercial actors. So that's sort of the short version. The longer version is that even if somehow you were able to convince someone that states parties also meant the citizens, the non-governmental people, it's not a self-executing provision, because someone has to go and pass a law to implement it so that it applies to the United States citizens and actors. So that means that it is not enforceable federal law against private citizens. And when I say private citizens, I'm including private companies such as SpaceX, Blue Origin, ULA, all of those folks.
So I have a question which will show my ignorance of the law.
No.
Which is why I really hate serving on juries. That's another question. So to get to launch a mission for a private company to go to the moon, whoever, I mean, to go to Mars, whoever it may be, SpaceX or Mars One or anybody, they will apply for a launch license.
Yes.
Okay, and assuming it's one way, they're not going to have a return license. So the launch license comes from the federal government.
Yes.
So if the company wants to go to a location on Mars with people, I mean, this is way down the road, so, you know, I understand I'm in fantasy land here. But if they want to go to a place on Mars with people that is not on the approved planetary protection place for any of 100 reasons that Cassie has told us on the show before, and listen, she's been on twice, so I would urge you to go listen to her programs because she really spells out what they may and may consider and where not. They won't issue a launch license. So really and truly, Article 9 applying to the state actor includes the FAA, which is going to issue the launch license, right? So,
well,
so how does that work? Because SpaceX can't go if they don't have the launch license. Article 9 may not apply to them, but it applies to the entity issuing them the space license, the launch license.
Well, actually, I would say it doesn't, because if you read Article 9, it says shall pursue studies. That's not licensing. That's just regulating,
right.
Including the moon, and conduct exploration. The FAA does not conduct exploration. So the government is acting in a regulatory capacity, and it has to obey all the U.S. laws, including all the Supreme Court cases, about how to regulate. And since the treaty doesn't say it applies to the regulators, it only applies to the scientific and exploration people like NASA, it is not going to apply to the licensing process. Now, where the licensing process looks like maybe the harmful contamination provisions could be applied is you use a different argument, namely in the Commercial Space Launch Act. When you go look at the payload review, it says that the FAA shall license, and this applies both to licensing the launch and doing a payload review of the payload. So the payload would be, you know, maybe a Martian habitat. And both of those have to be done consistent with foreign policy interests of the United States. So some people argue that that means that the FAA has to be implementing the Outer Space Treaty. Well, even if you accept that argument, when you go look at what portions of the Outer Space Treaty apply to commercial actors, this provision is not one of them. Maybe the non-interference provision is, but not this one, because it applies to the states.
So SpaceX gets denied a launch license because they want to put people in a habitat down around the equator, which which is not approved territory by the Planetary Protection Office and whoever else agrees with them. So they then probably have grounds to sue to properly enforce and issue them a launch license because they're regulating something that they don't have regulatory authority over?
Yes. So
at least that's a debate that you could have in court.
Oh, absolutely. So, because procedurally, you know, in terms of the process, this would all take years and cost lots of money, but this is what you could do. Let's say the FAA denied Mars One or SpaceX a license. The denial of the license is something that you have due process protections for, so the operator could take the FAA to court, and then the court could say, hey, FAA, you're trying to act like the legislature. Congress has not said anything about this, and so you are overstepping. You are exceeding your jurisdiction.
Well, this goes to the Supreme Court, so it'll be years before this got settled.
Well, it could go to, let's say it went to the district court, circuit court right away, and the FAA lost. The FAA could sort of sheepishly say, fine, we tried, and go home. Because, you know, NASA is not a regulator. So NASA is the one that has all of these places on Mars which say this is okay and this is not okay. So all those strictures apply to its own activities on Mars. And if NASA wants them to apply to commercial operators as well, it needs to persuade Congress to pass a law.
So, but SpaceX, being in California, might end up having to take this to the Ninth Circuit.
Well, that's an interesting question, because there's all sorts of rules about where you would sue.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, the Commercial Space Launch Act sends you to district court first, so that you sort of redo all of the same questions that you did in front of the agency
right.
before you get to the questions that you would want to take an appeal to. I would imagine, and this is based on a couple decades old memory of things, you can probably go to the D.C. Circuit, because that's here in D.C., and that's where the FAA is, or you could go to the Ninth Circuit. Personally, I'd rather go to the D.C. Circuit on this question. if I were them.
Yeah, well, yeah, if I'm a private company, I think I'd want to avoid the Ninth Circuit.
yeah, I would too.
But as a resident of California and an individual, if I have an issue, I don't probably have that choice.
Unless it's a regulatory matter with the federal government, then this would be something you'd have to check. How to sue.
But in the meantime, all of this procedural stuff is going on. It could take years. But if Congress really wanted to make this enacting, and since it's not self-enacting, Congress would have to do that. They could pass a law, and the president could sign it, and then all of this is moot unless that law is considered ex post facto and not applicable to their launch license.
Well, no, you know, if you pass the law, then it would become effective. Like, let's say they say it's effective next month, and then so anyone who's applying after that has to abide by that law.
But since
now,
they applied since they applied earlier than that, would they have to apply by the law, or does it go by the launch date?
Well, that's one of those tricky things you have to figure out. It would be good if Congress was really clear on that. This applies to licenses applied for after X date or to launches that take place after X date. That would be helpful if Congress were to be clear about that. Otherwise, you have to do a lot of research to figure it out.
So one can't count on Congress being clear, in my opinion.
Not always. But, you know, one of the other things that's really cool about this question, and, you know, you're talking about people going, and then, you know, the scientists have their interest in protecting various portions of Mars that might harbor Martian life, is one of the reasons you need Congress to say something about this is because, you know, Congress is the policymaker. And I'd like to distinguish between law and policy here. Law is what's the law? You can do this or you can't do that. Policy is whether something's a good idea or not, right? You know, whether it's good science, good idea, you know. But you could have bad policy be the law and it's still the law, or you could have good policy and it's not the law, but it's still good policy. So, you know, they're not the same all the time. So if you have this, if you're really, really worried because you've been finding extremely strange microbes that your computer tells you is going to, you know, pretty much deforest the United States and the entire Western Hemisphere, and they shouldn't be brought back to Earth, then you could say, please pass a law. And Congress would be okay, and they'd pass a law really quick to stop whoever was trying to bring that back. But that's sort of the extreme case. And here we have this word harmful contamination in the treaty, right? And it has been interpreted one way by various governments who do science in space. And that is, we want to keep a very, very clean petri dish out there. We do not want to bring Earth microbes so that we confuse ourselves as to whether there's life on other planets. And we don't want to say, hey, we found life on other planets, and it turns out we brought it. That would be kind of pointless. So they've been extremely careful. They sterilize things, they bake things, they get rid of all the microbes, they spend, you know, I saw one quotation from Ms. Conley, Dr. Conley, about $100 million on a mission to scrub it and sterilize it. Well, if you're sending people, you're not going to sterilize them. That would kill them. Because I heard on NPR that, you know, the human body is covered in bacteria. And so if you're sending people, bang, right out of the box, you are just completely messing up the whole science plan. So if Congress wanted to preserve Mars for science, it might pass a law saying no people can go, no space, no human settlement of Mars. Moon is okay because we know there's nothing there. There's no life there. But they could set up a complete scientific preserve. Or they could say, of course we're going to allow space settlement. And so it would be kind of silly to make commercial operators scrub the living daylights out of their hardware when we're going to allow people to go, because that's just an unnecessary expense that we've just made pointless by allowing this journey people to show up. So there's all sorts of little policy questions, they're not that little actually, that Congress would have to resolve. Is the scientific preserve? Are we going to forbid or allow space settlement? Are we going to encourage it? Are we going to have rules that are redundant? So those are the sorts of policy issues that Congress is supposed to decide and pass a law about, so that we know what the United States means by harmful contamination and to whom.
So I have an email question for you.
Sure.
So Alice is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she says, I regularly listen to David's show, but I don't regularly send in comments or questions. However, a frequent topic of discussion, and I might say promotion by a significant part of his audience, is the space settlement idea, and Mars seems to get more emphasis on space settlement than even the moon, although it may depend on who the guest is and what the show is actually talking about. If, in fact, this group promoting space settlement, they even want to change the NASA charter and have the national space policy say settlement is an obligation of NASA, I've never heard this group talk about planetary protection and any limitations that might be imposed on space settlement. In your opinion, if Congress does not enact any legislation to make Article 9 applicable to the private sector, is space settlement a dead issue? Is it unlikely? Is it heavily restricted and limited? Is it going to be extremely expensive to comply? What is the future, say, for Martian space settlement, given the status of the Article 9 provision today, and if they made it enacting?
I would say that if Congress does not enact anything to do with the harmful contamination provision of Article 9, then space settlement is legally a go. And that's because, you know, you're allowed, under U.S. law, if it's not forbidden, it's allowed. And so unless Congress says no space settlement, then you can go.
So even if other countries oppose it because of their law and regulatory system,
well, you might not be able to go from France if France has a different view than the U.S., but you could launch from the U.S.
You should
legally be able to. Now, I don't want to mislead people. I believe that there are folks at NASA who think that the government does have the legal authority to stop space settlement under current law, but I think they are not reading the treaty correctly, and I think they are not familiar with the concept of treaties needing to be self-executing.
So for the space settlement movement, and we do hear a lot about it on the space show and also at conferences, but what you're talking about is never included in that discussion. It's as if nobody even knows what you're talking about. How are we to react to the space settlement issue? I mean, like the National Space Society has an entire section and division of their ISDC conference talking about space settlement, and it's on their website, and I can list lots of other places that, you know, do the same thing. So are they unrealistic? Are they overly aggressive? Are they just ignorant? I mean, what are we to think?
You mean these are the pro-settlement people?
Yeah, the pro-settlement people.
Well, you know, what I'm saying is helpful to them.
I understand that, but it's likely to be challenged significantly.
Yes, yes. And so they should, they might want to make their voices heard on the question of Article 9, because you don't want to find out that, hey, I'm full of bacteria and someone's not going to let me go to Mars because of planetary protection principles that are not legally enforceable, but you can spend a lot of money fighting with someone about the legality of something. So, you know, that's part of why I'm trying to talk about these issues, is because I want people to know that they have legal rights here and that this is what the law says, even if perhaps their helpful government official might not mention it to them.
George is in Tucson, and he said, David has had people on the show that do want to change the way NASA looks at things legally, including in the national space policy, so that space settlement becomes a priority of NASA. However, given Article 9 probably being applicable to NASA, that's not going to happen no matter what because of planetary protection rules. Is that probably a fair reading of the situation?
Well, I don't know. I think that this is a little complicated because I've heard different things from different people. I think some people in NASA are, you know, on board with sending people to space. Other people think that that Article 9 poses a problem for astronauts on Mars because they would be a form of contamination. I would suggest that no one thought of people as contamination back in 1967. And that would be, you know, a very erroneous path for NASA to take. But I could see that someone might. You know, NASA's pretty big. It's got a lot of different people with different perspectives in it. So I just in the past 6 weeks, 2 months, heard different things from different people as to what NASA's views are on this. And I'm sure it's not, like, an official position held by the acting administrator.
Another email, and listeners, I really hope you start using the phone. It's 866-687-7223. Linda's in Seattle, and she said, David did a show just the other day where the guest was very opposed to Mars sample return, highly supportive of planetary protection, both from an Andromeda strain perspective, but also our contaminating Mars to the point where scientific discovery would be useless because of what we did to the planet. What about planetary sample return, bringing something back from Mars directly to Earth? How is that viewed under Article 9?
Well, you know, whether it's a good idea or dangerous and hazardous and risky is, of course, one of the policy questions that you would want Congress to resolve. But Article 9 does not stop anyone from bringing something back or from sending stuff to Mars, because the term harmful contamination is pretty vague. The fact that it has been interpreted to mean preserve science by a certain group of people who have access to taxpayer money and can use it to go do science, and it's great, but, you know, they're able to pursue their interests. But other people have different interests. So the people who want to, you know, set up habitats and figure out how to, you know, do mining and agriculture and, you know, grow potatoes, they also have legitimate interests. And I don't know that it is wise policy, and it's definitely not the law, that the interests of the scientists trump those of people who might want to go visit.
Why?
Well, even if all they want to do is be tourists, there's no law that says science trumps the tourism.
But in reality, it does, right?
Well, in reality, money-wise, sure. Right now, all the free money is going to the science. It is not going to tourism. But if someone came along with their own money and used it for tourism, there would be no legal basis. I mean, there are people who think there is, but they're wrong. There wouldn't be a sound legal basis for telling the tourists they can't go, because as long as they're going as private actors.
Has there ever been an effort since 1967 to make these provisions applicable to the private sector, especially in more recent years when the private sector has really become active and stepped to the forefront of the space industry?
Well, I think that I have to tread carefully. When I left the FAA a year ago, and one of my last projects was Moon Express. So I don't want to talk about the details of that from inside the government, because I have, as a lawyer, and have ethical obligations to the FAA. But I will say that since I've left, I have heard a State Department lawyer and others say that Moon Express voluntarily provided information about planetary protection. So it's kind of nice to hear the government recognizing that it was voluntary that Moon Express provided that kind of information.
Okay, so again, in talking to Cassie a number of times, they don't have the moon listed as a necessary place of interest for planetary protection, but they do list, she told us, three places, Mars being, of course, one of the three places. The others are so far out that we're not getting there anytime soon.
Uh-huh.
But Mars was pretty much, I mean, the moon was pretty much anything you want to do. There's not going to be any contamination or risk there. We already know that. We've done that, been there. So the moon is a much more benign environment in terms of some of the planetary protection issues. As I understood what she has said twice on the space show, and when John was on, who used to have her position and was with the UN, I got the same message. But then the game changes when you start talking about Mars and the other places.
For private actors?
That's really interesting. You're the only one who has ever in the 16 and a half years of the space show divided this Article 9 up with applicability to government actors and private actors. Nobody has ever done this before on the space show. They have assumed, when I've had John, I forget his last name all of a sudden, but you know who I'm talking about, and Cassie, who runs the Planetary Protection Office, and other lawyers who have supported this, they have just assumed, so it never becomes an issue, that Article 9 is applicable to everybody. And so there would never be a reason to divide applicability up like you're doing. And when you teased us at the end of the last time you were on the show, that's what caught my attention, because I had never, ever heard that in the 16 years of doing the space show. Since then, we've gone into our 17th year. So you're the only person who's ever brought this up. If I ever bring Cassie back on the show, you can believe me, I'm going to ask her how she sees all this as being applicable to the private sector. She may see it totally opposite from you. I don't know.
Well, does she have a law degree?
I don't believe she does.
I think she's a science person. And one of the things that lawyers are supposed to do is read what was written down and do that. We're not supposed to throw in a whole bunch of our own ones and zeros that we wish were there when they're not. And so I'm always saying this because this is what I'm reading. I was a regulatory attorney for a couple decades, and when you write rules, they have to be crystal clear. If you want it to apply to the launch operator, you say the launch operator. If you want it to apply to the launch site operator, you say that. And if you say launch operator and you really wish later you'd said launch site operator, too bad, you didn't. So, it's a code.
Mm-hmm.
you're supposed to follow it. And you're not supposed to surprise people by having a change from what the words really, really say or what they originally said, unless everyone goes and votes on it or goes through a rulemaking or changes the treaty. There's ways to change the treaty. They're spelled out in the treaty. If you want to change your mind about something, it can be done. It's just really, no one wants to do it because it's hard.
You have a caller on hold, but first, when you have testified before House and Senate committees, does Article 9 come up, and are the members of the committees aware of the distinction that you're making on today's program?
I think so. I have brought it up, and it's in my testimony. And also, I noticed that, I don't know if your listeners have heard about the American Space Commerce Free Enterprise Act.
Yeah, we've been talking about it a lot.
It's a House bill, and they call out a few provisions from the treaty that apply to state actors, like no nuclear weapons in outer space, right?
Right.
And that clearly applies to the states' parties. So, you know, the United States shouldn't be putting nuclear weapons up there if we need it that way. But it doesn't apply to commercial actors. So that bill makes sure that no commercial actors are going to put nuclear weapons in outer space. The bill that went through markup does not have any harmful contamination provisions in it. So I think that looks to me like at least the House Space Subcommittee recognizes that it doesn't have an obligation there under the treaty.
I thought it was law that private actors couldn't have any nuclear stuff, weapons or material or plutonium or anything without a government license.
Might be an American law.
Yeah, an American law.
Uh-huh. Right, right. But the treaty itself just says states parties to the treaty undertake not to place in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons, et cetera.
Let's see who your caller is. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Yeah, you raised an issue earlier about the idea of a treaty being the supreme law of the land or whatever.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, how does that interact with the U.S. Constitution in the sense that suppose...
In the U.S. Constitution.
What I'm saying is, okay, but there are rights in the Constitution. What if...
Uh-huh.
What if somebody proposed a treaty in the international sphere, which would essentially curtail or eliminate a U.S. constitutional right for U.S. citizens, and for some strange reason the Senate actually ratified it? I mean, I know it's pretty off the wall in a way, but...
No, it's not. It's not. You're asking a very good question because... There's lots of protections against Article 6, and one of them is this principle I was mentioning earlier about the treaty having to be self-executing before it becomes the law of the land. The other protection is that it has to be consistent with the rest of the Constitution. So, you know, the President and the Queen of England can't get together and decide, you know, that the First Amendment is dead. So there have been cases that have gone through the court system where someone says, well, this treaty requires this, and it's like, yeah, well, that conflicts with the First Amendment. So just like you can't have a law passed by Congress that violates the First Amendment, you can't have a treaty that violates the First Amendment. Also, the other way to deal with an unfortunate treaty provision that everyone, you know, may start to wish we hadn't signed and ratified would be for Congress just to pass a new law saying we don't agree to that part. And then we are a signatory to the treaty for everything except the part that Congress said we don't agree to that part. So
okay.
Congress can repeal a treaty, basically, by passing a law in whole or in part.
Okay, so that's another thing. Then on some of these space treaty things, could Congress just decide to withdraw from some part of it?
Yes, they have to pass a law to do it.
Okay, they have to go through the filibuster rule, I guess, 60 votes in the Senate, majority in the House, presidential signature.
All of that, yes.
You can't do it by executive order.
You know, that's a question I should know the answer to. It wouldn't be executive order. It would be, I wonder if the president by himself can... leave a treaty. I don't know. He might be able to.
It probably depends on what's in the treaty, maybe. Like
it seems unlikely because it seems like if you've got the Senate ratifying it, that you should, you need the Senate too. On the other hand, the president under the Constitution has a lot of independent foreign policy authority as well. Those two branches have the foreign policy authority. The executive and the legislative. So I don't know. I will tell you, I don't know the answer to that. I was thinking about
the ABM treaty and what was done during the Bush administration, but the treaty had a withdrawal provision in it.
Right.
You give them 6 months' notice.
Yes, but that's as far as the treaty goes. But the question is, under American law, who do you need to get out of a treaty? Does it have to be done by the president and Congress together, or can just the president do it? And I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, okay, that's a good point. Well, thanks a lot. I just thought I'd ask those questions. So basically, we're safe from somebody, well, I guess up to a point, depending on what courts decide, passing a ratifying a treaty that would take away a constitutional right then.
Well, you may have to fight for your constitutional right, because sometimes laws get passed, treaties get signed that do have unfortunate provisions, and you may have to fight over it.
You know, several years ago, and unfortunately I don't remember the details, and maybe my memory is going to be shoddy, but John, maybe you remember this, or maybe Laura, you even know it, but there was, and I don't remember who the president was, it might have been Bush, but there was some sort of a UN treaty or something that was going to be applicable to the United States that would limit our Second Amendment rights and put them in line with United Nations and an EU policy. And I remember there were lots and lots of objections and news articles and editorials and things that were being said. I have no idea what's truth or false or accurate or not. I don't even know how it all got resolved. But I do remember there was a lot of letter writing urged, and the NRA was active, and don't let the Senate accept this UN bill or whatever it was, or rule or whatever, because it would limit our Second Amendment rights. However, if that did happen, and the government in power used it to limit our Second Amendment rights, those that wanted to fight against that would have cause to fight against it by being inconsistent with the Constitution. Is that
right?
That's
right. You should certainly make that point if you feel that a treaty is going to do that to you. But nonetheless, things that are violations of various portions of the Constitution get passed. So, you know, I'm not familiar with the one you're talking about, David, but it's a.
I don't remember how it got resolved. I honestly,
it didn't get ratified. That's how it
do
got
you remember it. What it was, John?
Well, yeah, there was some kind of a, it's still out there, but it's a treaty about small arms, I think.
That's right, arms sales. It was to limit merchants in arms sales, but it also affected gun ownership of people, which would go against our Second Amendment.
Yeah, and it didn't get ratified. That's kind of what happened, I think. Because you have to have two-thirds majority in the Senate. I didn't get that far, I don't think.
Interesting. John, anything else?
I think that's kind of the things I was going to ask. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks, John.
So, listener, that does clear our lineup, and we're about at the halfway point, so I'm going to take our pause here. Our phone number, and we do answer the phone during the break, is 1-866-687-7223. And in addition, email drspace@thespaceshow.com, plus your comments on the blog as previously instructed. And when we come back, we have a surprise topic for when we start the second segment. So be back in about 3 minutes, everybody. Don't go anyplace.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The space show wants to make the dreams of space the reality.
Livingston? Well, we need a new CD, listeners, so... But welcome back to part two of our Sunday Space Show program. We have a couple of sponsors that we want to tell you what they have to say. Orbital ATK says they're a global leader in aerospace and defense technology and is the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration and commercial ventures and defense. And then AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is a sponsor. They're the world's largest aerospace professional society with over 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, and about 95 corporate members are there. They help shape the future of aerospace every day in their work and in their advocations and on the space show. And probably a very high percentage of space show guests, including myself, are AIAA members. They advance the state of aerospace science and technology, increase our knowledge of the universe, and bring us all closer together. Check them out at AIAA.org. And remember, if you are planning or considering planning going to Space 2017 in Orlando, please do let me know. I would love to meet you in person. So email me. I do plan on being there. And we'll set up a way to meet one another at the Orlando conference. And we thank you for paying attention to our sponsors' messages. So Laura Montgomery is our guest today. We've been talking about Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty. Laura, you do have a clarification about can the president get out of a treaty on its own. You want to give us what you've been able to find out?
Well, I did a little Googling, so, you know, this is not going to be anything that you'd call legal advice, but it does look like there's lots of different types of treaties, and the president can get out of certain of them, because the word treaty in international law is a little different from what is meant by treaty under U.S. law. So there's a whole bunch of international law type of treaties that the president can get out of, you know, can withdraw from without requiring Congress. But for a pull-up ratified by the Senate, treaty under U.S. law, he probably can't, because he's supposed to faithfully execute the laws of the United States. I may not be right. This was like 2 minutes of Googling, so don't take my thoughts here to the bank. But you know, the recent example that we've seen is the climate accord. It had not yet been ratified by the Senate, so that was an easy one for just the president to get out of. And then we saw the history, David and I were talking, the ABM treaty and another one that just the president left, but perhaps Congress was lazy in objecting strenuously, in not objecting strenuously enough, I should say. So maybe they shouldn't have done it, but I cannot tell.
So switching over, Laura, you are an exceptional science fiction writer, right? And you like to write about the fiction of Congress, right?
Well, I do write some science fiction. I would love to be called exceptional, but I don't know. I write a couple different types of science fiction. In the one, there's a lot of it's near space issues, and so a lot of legal issues show up, as well as orbital debris. And in the other, I write space opera, where, you know, your space marine is trapped on a lost colony world and has to deal with a semi-feudal society. But the stuff that's more germane to your show here, I do write under my own name. And the one that's truly is hard science fiction is called Manx Prize. And I posit that someone on the Isle of Man has offered a prize to anyone who can deorbit large pieces of space debris. So they're offering $50 million in gold, and then there's a race to deorbit the space junk. So that's my plug there.
Can we access this off of your website, or do you have a special science fiction website?
I do have a special science fiction website. It's lauramontgomery.com. And it'll take you to Amazon. I have these books on ebook on Amazon.
Speaking of space debris, I was at the New Space Conference a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco, and I had dinner with a chap from Russia who was working in San Jose in the computer industry. I hope I'm not now being investigated by the House or Senate for talking to a Russian, but, you know, you never know. He posed an idea, and, of course, I lost my cool because after a whole week of space cadet fever, I was at the breaking point. But he said, why don't we just go up and seize the debris and get rid of it? And I said, because, you know, there's all sorts of laws about doing that and liability issues and treaties. And he says, well, Russia will do it. Nobody's going to stop them, and on and on and on. And they would gladly do that. And I said, well, what if they seize somebody's private property, you know, under the registry and all of that? And they objected and they caused damage. And now the company has some liability, possibly, and they went after Russia. And he says, well, they just ignore it. That's what they do. So I kind of lost my cool. But he was actually proposing something like this as a serious idea to get rid of debris. Why don't we just go up there, grab the pieces of junk that are threatening, and get rid of them?
Well, in my prize, because, you know, I'm a lawyer and I wasn't going to have people, you know, doing unlawful things like what he's talking about, I have the contestants have to go buy the debris from the owners, because you don't lose your ownership rights just because you put something up there. And if it's a country and you know, it's under the Registration Convention, which is another UN treaty, you register and it's still under your jurisdiction. So, you know, maybe you'd have to ask permission of the other country.
Can you transfer ownership if you want to sell something?
Yes.
Or a piece of debris? You can do that?
You could, yes. And in fact, I know of instances where satellite operators have sold their satellites to someone else. And that's fine, because you own it. You own that satellite.
And then does the U.S. cease to be liable as the launching company country, or would they still have that liability?
Well, you know, I have to say that this is so much more fun to answer than when I was in the government. when I was a government lawyer, I was never going to say the U.S. was liable for anything. And so it was, liability, of course, always depends. You know, something bad has to happen. Someone has to have done something wrong. And depending on whether the damage takes place on Earth or in space, there's different standards of liability. Were you careless, or do we not care at all? If whether you were careless, if you caused it, you're on the hook. But now that I'm no longer with the government, I can say that sure, the U.S. government would still have liability exposure.
So
because it's a launching state.
So that doesn't go away if the private company sells the satellite.
Not necessarily. I mean, the way the treaty's written, it's not too murky there. You know, you're a launching state. If it went from your territory, or if you procured the launch, or if you launched it, or if your facilities were used. So if one of those four criteria are met, you might be on the hook.
So
I can't stop myself. I had to say might.
So then wouldn't the government have a right to block the sale if they didn't think that the new owner of the satellite was going to be responsible for whatever reason?
That I don't know the answer to. It depends on whether there is a mechanism in place. If you're a communication satellite, the FCC might have to approve the transfer of your license, but I don't know if they get to approve the transfer of your object. You know, are you still going to be transmitting into the United States? Then you need the FCC license. Are you going to use the same frequencies? You need the FCC license. And so the FCC might have a hook there, but, you know, would that be legal? I don't know. For the government to try and block the sale.
Are you working on a new science fiction book?
I am, yes. It is a sequel to in my Waking Late series in the Space Marine trapped on the medieval colony world. So it's the third, and wrap it up as a trilogy, I think.
And all of that information is on your Laura Montgomery website?
Yes, it is. My space law is at groundbasedspacematters.com.
Right.
But my science fiction is at lauramontgomery.com.
A couple of weeks ago, we dealt with informed consent again with Tracy Knutson from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we don't have anyone yet really going on an approved spaceship. I don't even think there is an approved spaceship. And I think the informed consent is supposed to apply to the approved spaceship, right?
So, license launches, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and they're supposed to give the participant, you know, all the safety and relevant history about the craft that they're going to be riding on. But how is that done when they're selling tickets already and no vehicle exists? It hasn't even been made yet. I mean, they're being tested, but they're certainly not close to being operational, let alone have a track record. So how do you sell the tickets? How is all this being done in the suborbital industry today?
Oh, boy. I'm not familiar with the mechanics of selling the tickets, but the I believe that, well, at least as of a few years ago, the FAA's position was that the informed consent requirements apply to the licensees, and so these people don't have licenses yet, and so they're obviously not, you know, going to take anyone up anytime soon. But and I think the other thing is that a couple of them, at least, are keeping the money they get from the prospective participants in escrow so that they haven't actually taken the money. And the reason the money is important is because the rules say before you accept any money, you must tell the spaceflight participants that this is dangerous, you could be killed or seriously injured, and the government has not certified it as safe, and this is its safety record, and the safety record of other vehicles like it, including government vehicles. So if you're taking someone up on a capsule, you got to tell them about the safety record of other capsules, something with wings, other winged space planes.
Would that include Russian capsules?
You know, we kind of left that alone, I believe, unless my memory's wrong, but I think we just decided we weren't going to address that.
So is there, by the time you left the government, were you aware if there was actually an industry-informed consent document to be used, or was it not yet developed?
Well, I think when I left, the FAA was in the process of developing guidance on this. But frankly, I think the rules themselves are very clear. You know, the documents should say the things the rules tell you to say, and the participant should sign it. And it's very straightforward. And sort of the longer you make the document, the less easy it is to understand that this is dangerous, you could be killed, seriously injured, et cetera. So, I think that some folks, you know, may have put something together. The guidance is pretty much restating the rule. So, you know, open up the Code of Federal Regulations and go to the part on human spaceflight that is regulated by the FAA and just set that out.
So when Tracy was on, she had some real eye-opening zingers for us.
Uh-oh, let's hear them.
So, they dealt with what she said is a current trend in the actual industry, not necessarily related only to space, but to the sort of adventure travel risk-taking industry where the insurance companies are using boilerplate type of provisions in contracts to say, life insurance contracts to say, you're doing too risky of an adventure, and here's how we rate that venture, and we're not paying off. And that is applying and will apply to the space industry. So she talked about the fact that Mr. Smith might sign all the documents and everything and then get killed, and the wife and kids may found out that they don't have any life insurance or anything coming back in because it's all being denied because this event, while not specifically excluded in the policies, may not meet the risk criteria by the insurance companies, and therefore they don't pay, so to hell with you. So
wow.
Are you at all familiar with this trend? I know this is specific to adventure travel and what she said was happening, and this was kind of a big zinger because the family could be left out in the lurch, and they may not have any awareness that this is going on.
Wow, well, I'll give you another one. You know, informed consent is just being told it's dangerous, right? It's not, it by itself, it is not a waiver of any claims. But at the end of 2015, and I had not heard of this, this is fascinating, I'm glad you told me. By the end of 2015, when Congress passed another commercial space law, the one with the asteroid miners, they also had a provision in there saying that until early 2020, I think it's 2023 maybe, the spaceflight participant has to sign what we call a reciprocal waiver of claims. In other words, it's an agreement. We're all going to agree not to sue each other. The spaceflight participant has to sign that with the launch operator. So not only, you know, Tracy has identified something rather alarming, but also the participant can no longer sue the operator, you know, if there was negligence and that was the cause of death.
So she did mention this, but this means if you're flying with company XYZ and they're negligent, normally they'd have liability and you could sue them. But now you can't sue them because they're barred from liability by law?
Yeah, because the law requires them to sign that agreement.
So who do you sue if there's negligence in the you're just SOL, right?
Yeah, kind of. You're not supposed to sue them, and you can't just, like, go sue your neighbor. They had nothing to do with it. Well, the people who are the fault, you know, who are at fault are off the hook.
Can you bypass that? Can a judge set that aside, or is this the fact of life?
Well, that's a good question. I remember I talked to Tracy a lot when we were working on these regulations, and she said that, you know, judges will turn themselves inside out looking for a way to say these types of waivers are no good, that they're invalid. And she was the one who said, you have to add death. I said, well, death is worse than serious injury, and if that's serious injury here, no, you have to add death, because otherwise the judge will throw it out. I'm like, fine, thank you, I didn't know that. So, however, she has told me that they throw these out as being against public policy, but if Congress passed a law saying that these have to be signed, then that seems to me an indication that the public policy is this. So you can't really say they're against public policy when they're required by congressional statute. So it's tricky. I wouldn't want to rely on some long lawsuit to get compensated if my spouse died. I would rather go pay an extra bit of insurance premiums, I think.
to make sure you have a policy that would pay off.
Right, right. Because what she just said is quite something.
Yeah, she said that this is a growing trend in adventure travel and risky things. And she talked about, like, what's the kind of skiing you do from an airplane or something?
The heliskiing.
Heliskiing, yeah. She talked about that as an example where the insurance companies rate the risk as such that they'll deny the claims on it, even though it's not specifically excluded in the policy.
Right, yeah. So you can't tell until it's too late. Yeah, that's harsh.
So what about these state no liability laws that have been passed by the various commercial spaceports in multiple states, and they attempt to make the launch operator and the state have no liability so that they'll come locate in their state. So, again, the participant is up the creek, right, unless those state no liability laws are pierced.
Right. Those laws would have to fail. Some of those, I can't remember which states do this, but a couple of them don't only protect just they don't protect just the launch operator, but all of the component manufacturers as well. But some of them give more protection to the space companies than does the federal law. And so that makes them very attractive as well to be, you know, little space law joke launching states. We don't know. We don't know until lawsuits are brought. I mean, one thing to remember, though, is that they are being told this is extremely risky. Space travel is not as safe as air travel. And so, but if you really want to do it, you get to. It's just that you don't get to take the industry down if something goes wrong. That's the thinking there.
So does informed consent include informing people that their insurance may not be valid, that they may be left without any protection for their family and spouses? Is that part of the guidelines that you talked about a few minutes ago, or is that buyer beware?
It's certainly not in the regulations, because, like I said, this is the first I've heard of it, so that's not something that we were thinking about when we wrote the rules.
So,
but it could be, if a court just says it is. If I were an operator, I would add that to my list, I think.
So the participant really needs to be aware of all these issues, or their attorney needs to be aware of it to advise them properly.
That sounds like a good idea, yeah, definitely.
Except that I asked Tracy if that meant people need an adventure travel type of expert attorney, and she kind of laughed at that and said there aren't very many of us in the United States that specialize in this field. It's a really small field. So then the question is, if you have a general attorney advising you, are they competent to really know all of the risk and what's in the small print, so to speak, to tell you about, or could you be being misguided by someone who's just not aware of all of this?
Well, that's true of any profession anywhere. You know, there's people who know more than other people. And I'm someone who knows a lot about this, and I just learned about the insurance policies from you just now. So you have to, I don't know that, I beg anything, though, David, that no one who's wanting to go up on a rocket is thinking, oh, first going to consult with my lawyer. People don't do that a lot, but maybe they should.
Well, they're probably going to be given a whole bunch of documents to sign that are legally
mm-hmm.
written by very shrewd attorneys. So
right, and people who can afford it are going to have money of their own, so they might.
Well, you know, if you're your own attorney, you know, you get what you deserve, so to speak. But for anyone listening who is planning to doing this, you owe it to yourself and family to really talk to people who understand all of this, because there's a lot of stuff in there that is happening that, you know, could not work well for your family if this thing blows up on the launch pad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which hopefully doesn't happen, but probably at some point it will. Do you foresee a time when things like informed consent and some of these issues will go away because human spaceflight will approach the safety and reliability of airlines, or is that day so far off in the future that it's not even worth having the conversation right now?
Well, you know, I have learned not to make predictions, especially about the future, as they say. But I worked on a rulemaking. It was this human spaceflight rulemaking at the FAA, so we're working on it feverishly in 2005 because we had a deadline from Congress. We had to get it out right away. And there's something in a rulemaking, by the way, is where the agency says, okay, these are the rules we're going to impose on the launch operators and the participants, and here they are. Public, give us comments. And then the public comments, and then the agency issues its final rule. And we're working on that, and we did and part of that is you have to do a cost-benefit analysis. And so we talked to industry, and they said, oh, there's going to be like 10,000 flights in the next 10 years. 10,000 flights a year, regardless. The number was 10,000. And so, you know, our cost-benefit analysis reflected that prediction. And, well, we don't have 10,000 now, and it's more than 10 years later. And so, you know, who knows? Who knows? This is This is something we'll just have to wait and see. I don't have inside information on how the various companies are doing with their engine development or anything.
Another email is Todd in San Diego, and mm-hmm. he says, I did listen to the Tracy show, and another thing she said, which she had also repeated several years ago when she was a guest on the show, was the fact that since the tourists are really participants in the space flight, there could be a situation where the tourist may have more financial liability on the hook than the space flight operator, especially given some of these rules that are coming down. My question would be, do these no liability rules to the operator and the component manufacturers and the others apply to the space flight participant, given he's not classified as a tourist?
Wait, which rule is the ones about liability?
Yeah, so they sign a okay. waiver, but is the participant, since he's part of the experiment, is he included in that waiver?
Well, so these waivers are now as of 2016, the participant is signing a waiver with the operator and with the U.S. government. And all of these parties to this waiver are agreeing not to sue each other. So that's what gets waived. Now, if a launch goes up and something goes wrong, a third party, someone on the ground, might sue all of these people. And those waivers would not necessarily, I don't know that those waivers shouldn't apply to the people on the ground. They can sue everyone, including the rich spaceflight participant. Now, the participant's estate would only have to pay out if the participant did something he shouldn't have, like opened the window or something when he wasn't supposed to, contrary to training. Then it might be his fault. But mostly it's not going to be his fault. He's just sitting there and maybe taking the harness off so that he can float around and then get back in his seat and come back. So he's not in charge of anything, and I can't imagine, unless he opened the window or went and attacked the pilot or something, that he would have any liability exposure. He might be sued because he's rich, because people do that, but he'd probably get out of the lawsuit pretty quickly.
But he'd still incur, the estate would incur expenses to defend
him. Some legal expenses, yes. Yes. And also, you know, unless they are able to say this guy did something wrong, I just used the opening the window example. Lawyers are not supposed to sue people with, you know, it's an ethical obligation not to just file a lawsuit against everyone for anything unless you have a basis for doing so. So they shouldn't sue people who are just sitting quietly in their seats.
But one could say the whole reason for this space flight that went south was because this guy wanted to go to space, so therefore he caused the whole damn thing.
I would consider, if I were a judge, I would consider that rather frivolous myself.
That would be a frivolous excuse.
That would be a frivolous claim. I don't feel worried that if my airplane goes down, that my family's going to have to pay because I'm a person on an airplane and I therefore, caused the airline to come into being or something.
But as a passenger, you have act rights, whereas a participant, that's not the same, correct?
Yeah, but the participant is defined in the law just as someone who's paid money to be on board. Calling them a participant doesn't make them more culpable.
But it doesn't.
Yeah, I wouldn't buy that. If I were the judge, I'd be like, dismissed.
So would you treat the participant the same as a passenger?
Yeah. Unless they did, yeah, but if a passenger did something on an airplane that they're not supposed to, you know, bash through a window and cause all sorts of horrible things, you could hold the passenger responsible. They have to do something wrong first. They can't just be there.
Well, we see passengers kind of doing some crazy things on planes.
Right, and if it caused the plane to be harmed, then maybe that guy should get sued because if it's his fault. Remember, there has to be fault. You can't just be rich to be sued. You have to be rich and done something you weren't supposed to.
Would you like to go to space?
Me?
Uh-huh.
I would like to go to space in about 40 years. I'd like to see grandchildren get out of high school, and I think it's pretty dangerous, but I'd love to do it.
But would you go one way and live on Mars? Would you be
settled? No. You know, mostly because I suspect it would be super uncomfortable, and I'm a baby. But I would definitely go up on some of these shorter flights where you get to be weightless and look at your home planet, and that would be totally, totally cool. But if I'm going to be super uncomfortable, and I think a Mars trip now would be very uncomfortable, I probably wouldn't do that.
We're coming up toward the end of the program. Do you see any changes coming up on the Outer Space Treaty? I know there have been the congressional hearings, and the mining industries says this and that. We've talked about this before, but do you see anything really changing with the Outer Space Treaty?
I don't see anyone trying to reopen it and you know, make amendments to it. That would be very, very difficult, and I think that the countries whose interests are most at stake would not want to, because it's not like things would get better. One thing I said in my testimony to the Senate is that the treaty is very broadly worded, and we have the ability now to interpret it so that it's flexible and conducive to space settlement and commercial operations, or we can choose to interpret it so that it's a big pain in the neck and very burdensome and expensive for all the commercial people. And I would strongly encourage everyone to interpret it the more flexible way, so that there is more freedom to act and people have a lot greater liberty in which to engage in commercial operations.
But that's from the U.S. perspective. There are others, I guess, that would want to be more rigid because they see space as a global commons and the private shouldn't even be up there.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're right. yeah, you're correct. There are those people, but I think that we should go with the reading it flexibly as opposed to reading it so that it's harmful to. I think that the commercial people are going to be the ones who get us out there. Yeah, regardless of the government inventing the internet, it becoming so amazing is because you have this permissionless environment where people can go try amazing things. Lots and lots of them fail, but lots and lots of them come up with really cool things so that we can have internet radio and text and, you know, I could look things up during the break. And that's because the commercial people are out there trying to make money. It's the world's greatest crowdsourcing approach to life.
Yeah, it's a much better driver than government planned doing any of this. But
I think so. I think we'll get a lot more activity once it becomes more commercial.
But I do meet people all the time that want government to take over all research, all medical research. You know, they're very much of that orientation. They somehow think that'll be fairer, lower prices, do this or that. But I'm not sure about how it would affect pricing, but I guarantee you it will not produce the innovation and the advances that the private sector produces.
No, and we've already seen that with space, where we're still in low Earth orbit. We have not yet made it back to the moon. Some collection or some company, one of these private actors will get us there.
I have one final email question that came in for you. This is Jared in Denver, Colorado, and he says, now that you have left the government and you have a private commercial law firm, can you, without naming anybody, tell us what your typical commercial space or space client is after? Is it regulatory relief? What do they come to you for, given your legal expertise in the space industry?
Some folks are talking to me about payload reviews, which is, you know, the new space people wanting to do something different from being a remote sensing satellite or a communication satellite.
Uh-huh.
But and then I'm also doing some work for some think tanks on the other questions about the Outer Space Treaty. But the bulk of my work has been financial responsibility. That's more like the bread and butter work is what I was talking about before, these cross waivers, insurance questions, and that's great. Pays the bills.
Interesting. Tells us that you're probably going to have a market for clients, you know, for the next 500 years.
At least for the next 20.
Any other zingers you want to leave us with, you know, for today that will bring you back?
I can't think of one, but if I do, I'll drop you a line.
Yeah, drop me a line because I'd love to talk to you again. And this has been really interesting and clarifying and maybe also somewhat confusing for some people. But it has certainly been interesting, and it's going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds over the coming years, because the private sector is driving this stuff, and there are going to be solutions needed to what the private sector wants to undertake and do.
Yeah. I agree. And, you know, David, you have a great show here, and I really appreciate being invited to be on it.
Do you have any more congressional testimony planned in the near future?
No. The second one was kind of a surprise. I'm nerve-wracking to do that.
Do they invite you, or do you ask to testify? What's the process there?
They invite you.
They invite
you. They send you a letter, and they send you an email, and ask you to, if you, and you, of course, say, I'd be honored and happy to, and show up.
Okay.
So if someone is interested in a little bit more of the legal underpinnings of some of the things I've been talking about, my testimony is on my website at groundbasedspacematters.com, and you can check it out there. There's some really nerdy posts, and there's some, you know, more interesting and exciting posts about property rights and things like that. So it's a hodgepodge of things I feel like writing about once a week.
Okay. And we will stay in touch with you. And thank you very much, Laura, for returning to the program today.
Oh, thank you, David.
Okay. And listeners, that's it. And tomorrow, AGI's guy is going to talk about commercial space management and traffic control. So they have a full system for that to wrestle some of it away from the FAA. I saw it demonstrated at the Space Symposium. And this seems to be a growing field. That's probably going to be a great one for regulators, don't you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The FAA is very interested
in commercial traffic management. And I guess AGI is one of the countries at the forefront of doing that. So T.S. Kelso is the guest on Monday. And then Zimmerman is back to either have you love him or annoy him Tuesday night and annoy you as well. So you don't want to miss that. And listeners, that's it for today. Everybody, have a great rest of the weekend and a good week coming up. Thanks to Laura Montgomery and all of you who sent in emails and to John's call. And again, have a great week. Goodbye from the Space Show.